So I think we're ready to go with the question session for Jerry. And I'm going to have to ask you if you wouldn't mind stepping up to this mic again, as that's the only mic available. State your name, please, and try and keep your questions brief. We all know that routine. I just want to tell you about next week's program while we're all here. We have Douglas Gold is going to be presenting on World AIDS Day. He's a resident of Calgary who's been living with HIV for 20 years, originally from Quebec. And he's been traveling all over Canada speaking on this topic. So I think we'll look forward to hearing him next week. And now I'd like to ask Jerry if she would come up ready for questions. And if I could start the ball rolling, Jerry, could you tell us a little bit about where the funding comes from for Fifth on Fifth Youth Services?
Thanks, Jill. The actually, our funding comes from a variety of places and ways. We run some of the programs are funded through Alberta Human Resources and Employment. Some of our programs are funded through Service Canada. And for those of you who are not familiar, that is the federal government. And we also apply for grants in many different ways that are very specific. And you get a grant to use for certain something, and that's what you use it for. And we also do our fundraising. As most of you know, every year we run a fundraiser. And this gives me an opportunity actually to say thank you to all of the community who supports us very well through our fundraiser. Our fundraiser is also called Investing in Youth. And we always have a wind-up evening, A Taste of Lethbridge, which most of you are probably more familiar with.
I can throw that. Good afternoon, and my name is John Boris, and thanks ever so much, Terry. I'd like you to enlarge, since you spoke two or three times, alluded to the language matter. And I have a little, concern on my own part. I'm an immigrant. I was 3.5 when I came over, 3.5 years. And I think you'll all say I don't have an accent. I don't think I'm any different than my kids, who are really quite different from me. I mean, I sometimes will talk about my homeland just as a reference, and they'll say, "Dad, that's behind us." Well, I say it is, but there's 1 foot that drags. And I noticed you mentioned language, and I know in Canada, I think we have tie-in. We think that if we do something different than the United States, it'll stick as Canadian. So we measure Canada by comparing it to the United States. And the easiest thing to do is language. Oh, we don't say that. You don't say that. You know the spelling. You know how it was. And I'm wondering if you ever thought of the problem there is with, we have not a unilingual society, we have a bilingual society. We don't have a multilingual society. But if we keep hopping on, everybody can be a part of a good Canadian, regardless of how you look, what you wear, what language you look. That's a bunch of you know what. And so what I'm saying is it not possible to emphasize, or should we? Maybe you disagree. English and French. French is here pursuant to when we formed the country, and you can stand a bilingual country. But when you go past that, I don't think you can succeed. And would it not be better if we minimize the involvement in other than French? They might not come from France, I don't know where, but stick to two languages or just stick to one language. When you come to Canada, you're a Canadian first.
Well, I guess the way I look at it, John, is that where we're coming from, I guess, is that these individuals that are coming in, they're coming in with other languages other than English and French. And that's exactly what we need to do, is to help them with some skills in English, because the majority of things are English. French would certainly, if they're coming in with French, they've still got a better chance. But if they're coming in with languages like Farsi and things that most of us have never, ever heard of, and for me, some of them are just very recent, then those are languages that are difficult for the rest of us. We just don't have any basis. And in fact, there's very few individuals who are available in small centers to be able to communicate with them in their own language, so that then it would be nice, you could have that translation. But that's not always possible. And so it's making sure that they do get a good grounding in language. Because language is more than just saying a word. It's understanding what that word means. And that's taking it to a whole different context. So hopefully that answers your question.
My name's Austin Fennell, and thank you, Jerry, very much for coming today. I'm glad you made the effort. I have two questions. The first question has to do with parents. Many of us were fortunate in going to school that we had the genuine interest of our parents, encouragement, provocation, and all those kind of things. But what's your experience of that? That's what I'm interested in. The second question has to do with, is who can you not help? Who can't you help?
Okay, I'm not quite sure on clear on your first question as far as parents. Absolutely, and I'm going to say sometimes we discourage their involvement because sometimes that we do need to talk to the youth themselves, because it's one thing to have a parent, and the parents do want the best for their children. But as parents, sometimes we have our own interests, and sometimes that can make it difficult for a young person. And, I mean, we may want them to go into a certain field, but maybe it's not what they want at all, or maybe that's not where their skills and abilities are. And so it's that awareness. Quite often we have a parent, and we encourage the parents to come in with the young person if they so wish. And it gives us an opportunity to sit down with that parent and the youth to talk about the services, to talk about how and what we can help them with. And then we do go for a second meeting with the youth alone. And that's when you find out what the youth really needs and what their goals are. And then you can actually progress from there. And your second question, who can't we help? Well, I'd like to say we could help everybody, but of course that's not reality either. Certainly, I don't think there's a youth we wouldn't try to help, but sometimes they're not ready, and sometimes they'll never be ready. But we certainly take it and try and help them where they're at. And sometimes we've had to say, okay, obviously this isn't going anywhere, and you need to take a little time and then come back and then sit down and we can go from there. But that is very rare. Usually there is something that we can do. And maybe that is, like I said, getting them on a casual labor program, and just the fact that they get to work for an hour or two somewhere. Or perhaps it's explaining how the library works. Or perhaps it's showing them how to use the internet. There's almost always something that we can do. So, certainly, there are individuals that end up in the criminal system. And again, we may not be able to help them at that time, but there is a time when they are ready to go forward. Mm-hmm.
Ruth Alzinga. Jerry, and if you said this and I missed it, forgive me, but I noticed in the brochure the number of visits that you receive from youth. And I guess my question that I need to know, and if you told me, I forgive me, how are those visits, how do those visits come about? Are they usually walk-in, or are there a lot of referrals from schools? Just how does that happen?
Actually, the youth come to us in just, you name it. Some are referred, some are walk-in, some are from other schools, from Alberta Works, almost anywhere. But we find that the majority, and I'd say the large majority, we're talking into the 90%, are from other youth. And that's where most of the referrals are. They say, oh, well, you know, and particularly there's no cost to them. And so they know they can come in and get help with their resume. And they know they can come in and they can talk to somebody. And so you will have one youth say, hey, so-and-so helped me get a job. And if you go down to Fifth on Fifth, they'll show you how. Or somebody else will say, well, they helped me get back into school. And so then they'll come in and they'll say, well, I need to talk to somebody about going back to school. So that's basically how most of them come to us.
Got a specific one for you, Jerry, about the O'Hara student program. One of the real strengths is that somebody from your office phones back the next day or two and says, how did so-and-so work out? Did you find them satisfactory? Now, occasionally, and I want to stress very, very occasionally, they weren't really up to my expectations because it was an attitude problem. And as a former teacher, I know attitude is so hard to change. You can change skills, but attitude is something else. How do your people who run your O'Hara student program work with the, say, the attitude problem students?
Well, basically our program, and we call it our casual labor program, anybody who wants to register to get onto that program has to go through an orientation. And through the orientation, there's a lot of these things that they're discussed, and they also go through a safety, just some safety skills and requirements. But when they go out to work, like Jill, when you phone in and we send out youth, they're sent out, and then we call you back, and we find out how did they make up? What was the issue? Did they do what they were supposed to? All of those things. And that's where we go from there. So if the individual, if you're phoning, and that's why we really like the employers, whether household, it doesn't matter where, to give us some good, honest feedback, because then they sit down with that youth and they share that with that youth. And if it's an issue that is something more, like with that, they would be able to talk to them and say, you know, like, this is not acceptable, you need to. And if it's something more serious, then they are put on a probation. And there's a time frame. They need their requirements. They have to go and see a case counselor. They have to be able to work with that case counselor and convince that case counselor that things will be different the next time before we will put them back out again.
Hi, my name is Moira Watson, and I just wanted to ask you about, you were saying in your proactive strategy for incoming immigrant youth, and it was sort of highlighted as well by Sarah Amy's last week, that the transfer of skills or the accrediting transferred skills from other places. I'm wondering how that process works, or if that is in fact something that is happening right now, or what the strategies are. How do we do that? Because I think that Sarah last week highlighted that there were a lot of difficulties for people transferring their skills, and for youth to, you know, it's hard enough being a youth, and so to compound on top of that, maybe not the pressures of supporting a family, but transferring a culture and an identity as well as the skills. I'm wondering what that process might be. Thank you.
That's a question I can't answer totally, but there are many, many, many difficulties. And Sarah Amies works with immigration services and knows about those difficulties more so than we do. but we are aware they're there. And there are many people right now that are working within the governments and everywhere else to try and make some of those changes so that the individuals coming in from these other countries can get recognized for their skills. Now, like all these things, none of them are fast. And we hope that as more and more of us are aware and more of us get involved, that some of those changes can happen. But it's not an easy process. I had an experience just recently where someone was trying to, they were a teacher in another country, and they wanted to come in, and they said in the end, you know, right or wrong, and I mean, it's just the way things are. It's not that it is wrong, but right now these are changes, is that there's a requirement for certain forms. You have to bring in certain forms in order to get your accreditation. Well, in these countries, they don't have those forms. So there have to be new ways found in order to transfer that. And that's really where it's at, as far as I know.
I'm Trevor Page. Jerry, thank you for your presentation. And thank you also for putting your annual report on the table. I was just glancing at it, and I note that in terms of the positions filled with youth between the ages of 15 and 24, you had 1,612 in 2004-2005. And I was wondering if you had any idea how many unemployed youth there were in that age group. In other words, you're helping 1,600, but how many are there out there? What proportion are you actually helping? It's probably a tough question, but do you have any sense of how many there are out there that also need help?
I'd say that annually we work with about 2,400 youth. Now, some of those individuals, when they put that together, for some of those individuals, the positions might have been part-time or seasonal. And so for some of them, that was, they finished one, they come in, and they were helped to find something else. And what that is combining in that age group from the different programs and services. We run some short-term programs as well throughout the year. And so it's at the end of that, helping them find employment. So how many that are actually unemployed would be a very good question. I don't know if I could give you that directly, partly because we're finding young people are starting to work so early. So you're getting them coming in. They're coming in at 15. Some of them are in school, but they're looking for work as part of it's part-time. And that goes right through age 30. We like I said, the majority we have are between 15 and 24. So it would be, I mean, when you think, I don't know what the stats are on all the youth, maybe I should know that. But in this city, but we have a lot of young people. And if you start thinking of anyone of the age group, that's a 10 years basically that they're getting into the workforce. And we're finding that the majority of them that are getting into full-time are, it's getting closer to the 23, 24. That seems to be more realistic as far as the full-time. But they're in part-time and they're in, and for some of them that means learning about themselves and learning about the workplace. They get into, they work somewhere, and their first job's maybe not so successful. And they come back and they need that help in direction in saying, okay, why wasn't it successful? And going from there. And a lot of it is there, a way of learning. I think it is probably more so now. The workplace and just society in general is more complicated. Everything is a little, even most of the workplaces today, if they don't have technology, if their skills are poor in technology, it affects them very quickly. So it's quite a variety of individuals that are helped to get into the workplace. I hope that answers your question. Well, and considering we use, I can't give you a direct answer, but considering we also deal with southern Alberta, so we're dealing with youth anywhere from in Picture Butte, Tabor, Fort McLeod, Pincher Creek, so it makes the entire area much bigger than just Lethbridge. So I can't give you an exact number.
Thank you so much, Jerry, for explaining one of our really outstanding community resources so clearly. And I hope a lot of you are going to take advantage of the invitation to the open house on December 9th. It's between 11 and 2, and I've dropped in a lot of times to Lethbridge Youth Services, and I know you'd be made very welcome. And we look forward to hearing more about your program and supporting you more, and we all look forward to meeting again next week. Thank you very much.